Hey everyone, and welcome to Risky Business number 282. I'm Patrick Gray. This week's show is a cracker. We've got a great feature interview with journalist and author Palmi Olsen about what the future might hold for Anonymous. Is it time for the Anonymous brand to be retired? The media has largely lost interest in its activities, but how could this phenomenon bounce back to the same levels of notoriety as it experienced in 2011? Stay tuned to find out. This week's show is brought to you by Senetas, makers of absolutely kick-ass Layer 2 encryption equipment. And if you're worried about latency in your CCTV or control system deployment when it comes to encryption gear, get in touch with these guys because it's Layer 2 stuff. It's very low latency. In this week's sponsor interview, we're chatting with Senetas co-founder and CTO Julian Fay about the latest developments in homomorphic encryption. This is where you can actually perform operations on data while it's still encrypted. It's all a little bit twisted, but it is fascinating stuff, and it's coming up later. Now, before we get into this week's show, I've got to remind you all out there to go and check out all of the talks we put up from OSCERT last week. We've uploaded something like 10 hours of presentations from the likes of Charlie Miller, Marcus Ranham, Mark Fabro, and HD Moore. Just head over to risky.biz/OSCERT. That is AUSCERT, or subscribe to the RB2 feed at risky.biz/feeds. But let's kick it off now with a check of the week's news headlines with none other than the Gruck, who's joining us via Skype from a swamp in Chiang Mai, filling in for Adam Boileau. And Gruck, in our first news story this week, we had a little bit of trouble here in Australia. It turns out the blueprints for our spy agency, they're building ASIO, which is our domestic spy agency. The blueprints for their big, shiny new $650 million building in Canberra apparently were lifted by Chinese cyber jarheads from some sort of contractor, and everyone's running around flapping their arms.
Yeah, no, this one's actually, it's pretty amusing. Initially, I was hoping for something much more exciting, like another of the Chinese counterintelligence moves against ASIO, to see if they were doing tracking Chinese spies or anything inside Australia. But it looks like all they did was hit a contractor. And picking up the blueprints, I'm not really sure that that's a massive breach of security. I think they can just go ahead with that.
No, I mean, everyone's losing their shit over here over this. And, you know, there's been all sorts of political repercussions for the government, and the Attorney General's feeling the heat. And honestly, I think if they stole these blueprints, based on what little I know of the way these guys operate, chances are the reason they stole the blueprints is so that they can save money on architect and drafting fees and just replicate the building somewhere in Shanghai.
Yeah, I don't see the massive thing, like, you know, oh, they won't know where the server rooms are. Well, yeah, they're going to be in the huge rooms with the massive fucking air conditioners in
them. Yeah, no, I know. I mean, the same thought did occur to me. You know, it's not like we're talking about the Australian embassy in Beijing. We're talking about the headquarters for a domestic spy agency. I mean, who would be responsible for doing a bit of counterintelligence and whatnot? But yeah, it doesn't seem like the biggest example of scary shit on the internets.
If they're sending people to sneak in, having the blueprints is not necessarily going to get them that much further along. I'm not very impressed with that one.
Oh, now speaking of where they may have actually achieved a little bit of a victory here, there is a report in the Washington Post that says, that quotes a confidential report that says a whole bunch of US weapons system designs have actually found their way onto Chinese networks. Now, you would think if you're in the American defense establishment, that's kind of not very good.
Right. There's actually there's two interesting things going on over here. One of which is the Chinese are actually very, very good at targeting. So their cyber tradecraft is not particularly interesting. It's a whole bunch of phishing emails, some very, very low-level rats and malware. But their targeting is actually quite good, right? Mm. So if you or I were to sit down and come up with, you know, like the super best, most elite Trojan ever, that's something we could do. But the odds of us figuring out exactly which computer we need to be on to get the blueprints for how to make an F-35 are remarkably low.
Mm.
Like I have a vague idea that it's maybe Raytheon or Lockheed or one of them. which narrows it down to like maybe 500,000 computers or something, right? So the Chinese are actually very, very impressive in how they've been able to do their targeting. I think the other thing that's kind of funny, actually, to go back to the Asia blueprints, is the way that the report came out was from the U.S. intelligence services saying, by the way, we found this in China, which obviously has to be how they got the list of U.S. weapon systems, which proves the Chinese point that they're getting the shit hacked out of them by the U.S. all the time.
I like the way you brought it around to that. But apparently the designs that were stolen included those for the Patriot missile system. There's also the Terminal High Altitude Area Defense System and the Aegis Ballistic Missile Defense System from the Navy. So seems like they're getting some bang for buck in terms of spending a little bit of money on owning up this stuff instead of developing it themselves. I will include a link to that article in this week's show notes. But moving on to some news out of the criminal world and libertyreserve.com, which has become the sort of PayPal of choice for the criminal underworld, has been shuttered. And I believe, you know, millions and millions of dollars have been seized, including, I think, something like $37 million here in Australia by Westpac. I mean, these guys didn't ask you to provide any sort of identity information. So you could be like Mr. Dix from Dick Avenue in Dixville, and they'd give you an account.
Okay, so that's not entirely true. They did require an email address.
Oh, I see. So it's totally verified then, right? Yeah.
Right, right. So it could totally be traced back to MrDix@gmail.com.
Yeah.
Which is, you know,
which is a pretty awesome email address, let's be honest.
Yeah, that must have been snapped up in the first year.
But this reminds me of eGold all over again, right? I mean, these services, they always get shut down.
This is not the first time. It's not even the second time. This is the third one that's happened. So there was eGold, which was the PayPal of choice about a decade ago. Then all of the Russians moved to WebMoney, or WMZ, as it's called. And that one didn't get shut down. It actually got taken over by the FSB, which was much more insidious. Mm. And I have to give a lot more credit to the Russians on this one, the Russian law enforcement, that is. They, by actually just saying, all right, you guys can keep using it, only it's going to be run by us now. That's a
right. Well, I imagine it would have turned out to be quite handy in some investigations.
Right. That basically plays into the Russians thing of you're allowed to piss in the tent as long as you're inside the tent pissing out.
Yeah, yeah, exactly, right? But I mean, if anything, we're entering, you know, the cryptocurrency age. Bitcoin has really taken off in the last couple of years. And you would think that the shuttering of a service like this will push people towards Bitcoin and services like that, because sure, you can regulate the exchanges and make sure that when you pop out of the Bitcoin network and turn your Bitcoins into real money, you can regulate the exchanges so that they have to keep identity information. But, you know, if you're just doing stuff within the Bitcoin network, you can't shut down the Bitcoin network. It would be implausible to do that. And you can't regulate it. So I think probably this is going to, if anything, it's just going to push the bad guys towards cryptocurrencies.
I completely agree. And I actually think that that's a very bad thing for cryptocurrencies. Mm. Right. If you are a Bitcoin proponent, the last thing you want is the child pornographers.
Well, that's why some of the bigger exchanges like Mt. Gox are really putting up their hand and saying, please regulate us, because they really don't want that to happen. They want to legitimize the market. But, you know, it'll take time to realize whether or not just regulating at the endpoints, the ingress and egress points for, you know, real money to Bitcoin will be enough. But yes, libertyreserve.com is no more. Now, moving on to a bit of hacktivism, anonymous-y sort of news. This guy, Jeremy Hammond, has pleaded guilty to attacking Stratfor, and he's like owning it and just putting out statements going, yeah, I did this and I want to take down the man and stuff. And it looks like he's going to go to prison.
He's definitely going to jail. He was basically the member of LulzSec with skills. He had the best OPSEC of the lot. He still got owned up by Sabu. There's some interesting stuff happening. He's using the opportunity of his pleading guilty to make a big political statement about how he was only sort of targeting legitimate, intelligence agencies, security agencies, and all of these other things that were supporting the imperial infrastructure or whatever his specific words were, and it's very amusing to see how the U.S. prosecutor is trying to say, well, you know, Jeremy Hammond targeted people that he did not like, such as the police, the private security companies, and intelligence agencies, which doesn't actually come across as people he didn't like. It comes across that it actually was politically motivated. It wasn't a personal vendetta. So
Yeah, but I
I
mean,
think.
you've got to think. I mean, there's civil disobedience and then there's criminality, right? And I know sometimes the line gets a bit blurry, but breaking into Stratfor and doxing the, you know, and releasing all of their emails out onto the internet, you would think. I mean, I think it's hard to justify as an act of civil disobedience.
Oh no, completely. I think it goes far beyond civil disobedience. It is flat out plain criminal, but it is consistent with his political viewpoint. He hasn't betrayed, unlike the other members of LULSEC who were basically hitting anything and everything that they could find with SQL map. He was actually very, very clear on what he felt was wrong,
He actually had
and
a
I
bit of
have,
direction.
yeah, and I. I think that might have come down to the fact that he had the skills that he could follow through with his direction rather than allowing his skills to dictate where his direction went.
Exactly. Instead of reverse activism, which is, wow, file include vulnerability. Let's find out what this company does that we don't like. But he's looking at up to 10 years in prison and having to pay restitution of up to $2.5 million. But he was looking down the barrel of 30 years if he had have gone for the not guilty route. So we'll bring news of Jeremy Hammond's sentencing when it actually happens. Now, moving on, Twitter finally has enabled two-factor authentication, which I mean, there goes the Syrian Electronic Army right there, right? Goodbye, guys. Fold up your tents. Time to pack it up.
In theory, I mean, like on the one hand, good job to Twitter. It's about time that they've actually done this. On the other hand, the way that they've implemented it does not allow a large organization with multiple people controlling a Twitter account to have two-factor authentication. I think it is still going to cause problems, and I think the Syrian army still has a few months left in them. The particular difficulty is if, say, that you're for example, the BBC, the odds are that you don't have one single phone that can receive an SMS that will be the phone for the person that updates the Twitter account for all of the BBC.
Maybe they need a
Right?
Twitter phone that they can just.
Exactly. So I think that there's still an opportunity there to bypass it. It's definitely raised the bar quite a lot, but I don't think it's quite perfect for the news organizations that keep getting hit.
In somewhat related news, Kim.com, aka Kim Schmitz, aka Kimball, is claiming that he actually owns two-factor authentication, and he's saying to Google and like Twitter and stuff, he's saying, "Hey guys, you know, I could kind of use some money for my defense, and you know, you can chip in, or I can sue you because I own a patent that I got in 2000, which applies to two-factor authentication." Kind of funny, right? I love how this guy trolls.
Okay, so that might not be the most credible threat if you're saying, I'm desperate for money to pay for my legal defense. If you don't give me money, I'm going to sue you.
Please license my patents. But this guy, I mean, he's
I
entertaining.
mean, he certainly is. I'm not sure that, you know, in terms of a credible threat, he had a patent in Europe on the same thing, and it was invalidated. So that's certainly going to impact his ability to go to trial with that same patent or a related patent in the US. That's not going to go well for him.
But I mean, you would hate to think that his intellectual property rights could be violated, right? Because he's, you know, he's all about protecting IP.
The great bastion of intellectual property rights. I mean, the thing is, he actually, his patent does look pretty good in terms of what two-factor authentication has become now. So you have to give him some props for being a visionary in some way. I don't remember in 2000 or in 99 when he filed this what the state of the art was for two-factor, if anyone was doing anything similar. So I am actually slightly impressed that he got the patent. I have to give him credit on that one.
Link to that story in this week's show notes. Now, WikiLeaks, apparently donations have slowed down substantially. Obviously, that's what happens when you choke off the money supply through Visa and MasterCard, which was a decision that I think was completely spineless, even though I've got my own problems with the way WikiLeaks operates. But apparently they only scored $68,000 in donations in the last year, and they spent something like $500,000.
Does it really cost that much to keep someone alive in a an embassy?
Well, I mean, they're kind of a little bit fuzzy about what they're spending their cash on, right?
Yeah, it seems weird. Like, I'm not a huge fan of WikiLeaks, to be honest. I think initially what they started out with was good, and then they really went off the rails and disappeared up their own assholes a while ago. So the fact that they're not getting donations, you know, While I don't think that the politically motivated angle of it is particularly good, I'm not thrilled with that. I'm not terribly upset, on the other hand, either, that that people aren't very keen to find a way to get money to WikiLeaks.
Yeah, this is the thing, isn't it? Because a lot of people, I suppose a lot of WikiLeaks supporters will say, well, of course the donations have dried up. You won't allow these people to actually donate money to us, and, you know, it's all, you've choked off the supply because WikiLeaks is dangerous. Whereas I think really the public sentiment has kind of turned against WikiLeaks.
No, I completely agree. I think that, I mean, if you are desperate to get money to them, you will find a way to do it. If the world is, you know, they haven't been in the news that much. They haven't been doing anything major for the last year or so. They haven't really, other than the ongoing, very, very slow burning scandal of Assange, not much has been happening with them. And that's basically the way the world works. Like, once you stop being in the public eye, the public stops giving you money.
Yeah, indeed. Now, in some more traditional InfoSec news, nothing staggering here. Drupal.org got owned, and there's been a global password reset across the whole thing because millions of accounts apparently may or may not have been compromised. Nothing really. I mean, sad thing is, these sort of breaches are routine.
Yeah, well, to be honest, I'm just shocked that it wasn't core Drupal that was hacked. They're claiming that there was via a third-party plugin.
Yeah. They're like, we got owned, but it wasn't our own code. Yay.
Yeah, it's not our fault. It's someone that we trusted.
Yeah.
Well, you know, welcome to the internet.
Yeah, that makes it heaps better, right? Now, there is a bit of an interesting campaign going on out there at the moment. There's a five-month-old Ruby on Rails exploit. It is apparently patched. It has been patched for a while. The exploit's been in Metasploit for, like, you know, since January. But someone is going around building a botnet of compromised Ruby on Rails servers with IRC connect backs. It's kind of like, it's a little bit old school. It's kind of cool.
IRC, yeah. No,
IRC for command and control. I mean, what year is this, right?
Yeah. Well, what's actually interesting about this is that the botnet that they're building is on servers rather than on home machines. Mm. So one of the things that FX has mentioned is that a lot of the main botnets that he's seeing these days are actually based in data centers, that they are being built on server farms. They're not being built with large numbers of home PCs like that. That still exists as a vector for building botnets. But if you want to have, you know, that like 300 gigabit per second assault, you're not going to get that with a whole bunch of 512 kbit uploads.
Yeah, no. Yeah. Well, I think that's why everyone is going for stuff like, you know, we're seeing like WordPress worms and stuff going around just hosing, you know, hundreds of thousands of WordMess blogs,
right,
with,
right,
you know, plugin vulnerabilities and stuff.
Yeah, but it's not in the core code. It's just in code that we trusted, so it's okay.
Yeah. So if you've got a Drupal.org account, you might want to go reset your password. Now, there's an interesting report here on ThreatPost, which is really continuing this conversation of what do we do about cyber espionage, because, you know, rolling firewalls and corporate licenses of AV products doesn't seem to have got us very far. So they're trying some lateral approaches here, and one of them is to, you know, do things like put sanctions on companies that are stealing IP from Western organizations. So they'll say, okay, fine, you can steal our latest windmill design or our wind turbine design or whatever. But then if you try to open a company or a US bank account, tough titties, it's not going to happen. This is an interesting approach and probably one that will be more successful.
I completely agree. I think to some degree, the theft of IP as opposed to the actual espionage, like stealing weapon systems, is just a market problem, right? And the solution is a market solution. Like putting more AV is not going to actually help keep your product from being stolen. But if there are legal sanctions against people trying to resell your stolen product, that actually has a high chance of working. So I honestly think that this is it's a clever approach, and I think it has some chance of success. I'd be very interested to see if they actually can find a way to go forward with it, because putting sanctions on China, who owns your entire manufacturing arm.
Yeah, well, you can't. I mean, any sanction is going to have to be targeted, right? And this is this story is based on a report by the Commission on the Theft of American Intellectual Property. We've also seen a bill sponsored by John McCain in the United States that would call the Stop IP Theft Act or something like that, that would see these sort of targeted sanctions happening. But I think one thing that's interesting about this report is they really are talking about turning it into taking a market problem and allowing a market solution, which is one thing they want to do is amend the Economic Espionage Act to allow companies to sue for damages from IP theft, which is a terrific idea.
No, completely. As I've said before, I think that this actually has a chance of working. All of the other stuff, blaming companies, the blaming the victim approach for not being secure enough, the security awareness training, the billions spent on AV licenses and IDS and all this other crap that doesn't work, it's not the correct approach. It's not going to fix the problem.
No, we'll sue you into oblivion, might.
Exactly. Mm. So, good luck to him.
Now, speaking of major ownership, Google, was owned in 2010 as part of that Aurora campaign. Apparently, the attackers managed to access Google's sort of surveillance database, their lawful intercept database, and that's bad.
Yeah, no, this is actually very, very interesting stuff. The counterintelligence angle on this, I think, is, first of all, it's brilliant targeting by the Chinese, round of applause for that one.
But second golf clap.
But second of all, this really gets at the heart of one of the problems that's happening now, where the FBI and the CIA and the NSA are trying to do more surveillance and more tracking, and it's now being used against them by the Chinese. So anytime that they add additional surveillance capabilities, they have to realize that those surveillance capabilities are going to be used by absolutely everyone.
Yeah, well, it seems like these guys they gained access to a database, just reading from the report, a database that Google uses to process court orders from law enforcement agencies seeking information about customer accounts, including FISA orders, which are classified and that are used in foreign intelligence surveillance investigations. So it really is turning their own surveillance apparatus completely against them, which is quite brilliant. Now just turning to, Luigi Auriemma is always out there doing some pretty cool bug research. He has a habit of going for lateral stuff. Recently, we've seen some of this stuff already, but he's been looking at game security, and he's just had a go at the engines behind like first-person shooters like Quake 4, Monday Night Combat, and Homefront and whatnot, and he's found a whole stack of bugs. Cool stuff.
Yeah, it's not really surprising. These are very much the weak targets. Basically, one never really assumes that a gaming client or a gaming server is even that interesting, unless you're part of the culture where, being able to do gold or items and so on is interesting. You don't really care about the stuff. You tend to think, servers or things that will get me into companies. But he's definitely done some interesting stuff here. I know some other people that have been looking at the DRM clients as well as another one, and that's that I think will be very interesting is a friend of mine, Wirepair, Isaac Dawson, who has been doing some work on DRM stuff. And that gives you access to millions of hosts.
Yeah, it does, because they tend to roll pretty generic stuff, don't they, from third parties into this.
Exactly. Yeah. So they bundle it, and they all have to be connected online now to work. So it's absolutely brilliant.
Yeah, well, I remember one of those Java bugs going around was weaponized recently, and everyone was saying it was APT and China and stuff, and it was actually mining Minecraft creds. And I just thought, yeah, this doesn't actually sound like a PLA plot, to be honest. But now staying with bugs, and PayPal is apparently fixing a basic cross-site scripting flaw on its website. But it was an interesting story. This 17-year-old German student named Robert Robert Kugler, found the XSS bug, reported it to them, and then they said to him, look, we can't pay you because we can only pay people who have a PayPal account. And being 17, you know, in Germany, you can't actually have a PayPal account yet, so we can't pay you. And then he sort of pushed back on them, and then they said, well, actually, someone else already found this bug, but not an incredibly well-managed process on PayPal's behalf. And, you know, we're sort of left with the sense that they might not be telling the truth 100%, right?
Yeah, well, PayPal always manages to snatch defeat from the jaws of victory on these PR things. Yeah, I don't know how they are. You know, it's a real skill that they should be offering to other people. Like, it just, if you have a PR problem, come to PayPal, and then whatever we suggest, do the exact opposite.
But, I mean, do you buy their explanation that, I mean, if initially they were saying, no, you're too young, we're not going to pay you, and now they're saying, oh, we already had it? It just doesn't, I mean, it seems like they're bullshitting.
It doesn't add up. Yeah, their bug bounty system has been spectacularly mismanaged. This is not the first time that they've pulled the, oh, someone else already found it, which is very bizarre because every time this happens, the guy who finds it posts it on Reddit or on a mailing list somewhere, and no one else steps forward and says, yes, I found that and claimed the bounty already.
Yeah. Well, I mean, and you think, I mean, who gives a shit, even if two people find it? I mean, if you're flinging them a $500 bug, I mean, just dodge the bad PR, for God's sakes, right?
Exactly. I mean, the amount of bad press is probably worth more than the $500, right? It's more impactful at this point. So I don't see how they're helping themselves. They should either cancel the bug bounty or reform it or change the management because they're f***ing it up no end.
Yes, indeed. Now, moving to some iOS news, and there's some remote code injection bugs in a few iOS apps, which are kind of interesting.
Yeah, the targeting of iOS apps themselves, I think, is going to be a bit of a rich area going forward.
Yeah, because iOS is actually decent, right? So moving to the apps makes sense. So,
exactly. This is sort of what we saw happen on Windows as well, where initially Windows itself was so wide open, it was just heavily abused. Once Windows started getting locked down, people moved to applications running on Windows, which were more open. So iOS itself is quite locked down, so people moving to the applications makes a lot of sense. And once you've got an installed user base of however many millions that you have, even if only a subset of them are running the target app, that's still quite a large percentage.
Especially when those bugs are easy to come by, right? So all you need is a little database of them, and then you can work out, you know, which bug you need to use for which person, and away you go.
Exactly. So as FX said at one point, he couldn't imagine a worse language than Objective-C. So in terms of being able to find security bugs, Objective-C is so bad, they've actually reintroduced format strings.
So ooh, format strings. Jesus, really? We're back to that?
Yeah. So we've somehow gained 10 years on security of the operating system and lost 10 years on security of the runtime.
Yeah, so nice. Well, apparently these guys from a company called Vulnerability Laboratory, you know, no points for creativity there, guys. I'm sorry. They found the bugs on the latest builds of an application called FileLite and FilePro. So anyone who's interested can go forth and read some more about that. Microsoft apparently is having some success in mitigating losses from this click fraud botnet called Zero Access.
Yeah, Microsoft is actually, they're really taking the fight to malware, which, you know, you have to give them, once again, you have to give them credit for stepping up to the security stuff that they're really going after all of these botnets and so on. On the other hand, they write shit software, so they are to blame. I don't really know what's coming.
You don't really know whether to give them a pat on the back or a slap across the head, do you?
Yeah, it's so I know a lot of people there, and they're all very nice, but they work for Microsoft, so.
But no, it looks like they're actually making some headway there. There's some, you know, we can chalk this one up into the win column anyway. That's a Threat Post article again. Link in the show notes. Not really worth discussing too much, but there has been a Mac OS X backdoor that's sort of popped up in the wild. I guess the only thing that makes this one interesting is that it was signed with a valid Apple developer certificate, which kind of did a little bit too much to bypass Apple's rudimentary protection in OS X, which they, I love how they give it a big fancy name like Gatekeeper, you know, which is really some very, very simple rudimentary AV and code signing checks. But it is interesting. We're seeing some malware out there that's, you know, starting to leverage those types of techniques, right?
Yeah, so there's two or three interesting things on this. First of all, app.in has finally been caught in the public. App.in has been known about privately for a year or more, for definitely quite some time by a lot of people. But until someone publicly calls them out, no one was going to say anything. And they have finally been hit now, and I think that's very funny. They're denying it, of course, but you know.
So this would be the developer from which the code signing keys were snagged,
right? It's an Indian company that's been doing a lot of malware development, ostensibly for attacking Pakistan and helping India, but their code keeps getting found in all sorts of very unlikely places. Like servers in Russia, which
also
I'm
these
not
guys
sure.
Actually had their own. They actually managed to snag themselves a legit developer key. Well, cert.
Well, I think actually what they did was they got someone on Elance to do it for them, which basically completely bypasses Apple's. So this would be the other interesting thing that they've done is they found a way to bypass the Apple security of Gatekeeper, where you know who the developer is. If the developer is willing to accept the risk for, you know, a $1,000 development fee, Gatekeeper turns out to be useless because all you can do is track it down to someone who accepted a job on a website and got paid money to develop, you know, in this case, very, very shitty software. But, I mean, it's terrible. Like, you can get rid of it by removing the application called mac.app, right?
Yes.
Yeah, so
it's not exactly persistent.
Right, it's basically what you'd get if you buy your malware from someone on Elance.
Okay, right, got it. Okay, don't really want to spend any time on this, but Apple has actually released a patch for QuickTime, which addresses 12 vulnerabilities. Google's fixed a dozen flaws in Chrome version 27. Oh, this one's interesting. It's something we've spoken about on the show before, but there are these online Skype resolvers where you put in someone's Skype name and it spits out their IP, which is obviously not a good thing. Skype has actually been patched against that, which we like. And finally, Google has actually will begin strengthening the keys on its SSL certificates to 2048 bits. And they're making it known because they know it's going to break stuff and they want people to be ready for it.
Yeah, no, Big up to Google on that one. You know, it's probably about time to move off 1024. I had some quick points to make with the QuickTime bug release and the Chrome bug release.
Sure.
If you look at the announcements, not one of those 12 bugs for QuickTime was found by Apple. They're all ZDI bugs. So Apple was basically just letting it bit rot until ZDI came along and paid someone to fix their shit.
So you think they're not exactly doing a tremendous job of auditing their code?
Right. So Apple is particularly bad at the security angle. They really don't care. Whereas if you look at the Google stuff, while there's certainly a large number of external people who found bugs, and they tend to be the same people over and over again. These are guys who are actually, you know, making a portion of their income from a well-run bug bounty program. I don't think anyone could live off a PayPal hunting. Right. But Google actually has internal people finding these bugs. So Google is actually investing quite a lot in security. So again, Google and Microsoft doing well, Apple not so much.
You really don't know how you feel about Microsoft, do you?
No, I have refused. I'm a 90s Linux user. I have hated Microsoft since like 96 or 97.
Do you still spell it with a dollar sign for the S?
No comment.
All right, Grok, we're actually out of time, my friend, but thank you very much for joining us on Risky Business to be this week's news guest.
Excellent. Thank you.
That was the Grok there with a look at the week's news headlines. Big thanks again to this week's sponsor, Senatas, and our hosting provider, Virtual Office. Our next guest is Parmi Olsen, the author of We Are Anonymous, Inside the Hacker World of Lulzsec Anonymous and the Global Cyber Insurgency. It's a great book, too, if you haven't read it. And Parmi is also a journalist for Forbes. And her coverage of all things Lulzsec and Anonymous back in 2011 was unrivaled. Now, she was at Auscert last week to do a talk on the future of hacktivism, which, you know, I normally avoid topics like this, like the plague as features, but Palmy really has an insight into this whole world. And hers was one of the talks I recorded and posted as a part of the Auscert coverage on risky.biz, as I mentioned earlier. So just head to risky.biz/Auscert to grab all of the talks we posted, including Palmy's. Anyway, one thing that really came through in Palmy's talk was this idea of a symbiotic relationship between groups like Lulzsec and Anonymous and the media. So I had some time to chat to her after her talk and asked her to expand on that. Here she is.
If you talk to some of the people who were organizing Anonymous attacks and who were part of Lulzsec, one of the things they often refer to when they look back on what they did was the media attention they were getting. And for them, that was a big thing. I know that when Lulzsec was carrying out its 50-day hacking spree, at one point, Topiary had it on his screen, this is Jake Davis, a kind of graph showing all the different Google mentions they were getting, the number of headlines they were getting, and how many retweets they were getting. And so for them, that was a really important source of feedback for them from the media and also from social media. And certainly I think it fed into this drive for notoriety and for infamy, which is something that drives a lot of hackers. So I think in one sense, yes, the media played an important role in Anonymous kind of keeping going and feeling that the people within it feeling that it was important, that it had notoriety to it. And
But the media largely had it wrong, didn't they? Because we'd see headlines saying, could Anonymous topple governments? Which, with 2020 hindsight, I think even the people who were responsible for headlines like that are feeling a little bit embarrassed by them now. Would you think that's a fair assessment?
Yeah, I would certainly think so. And when you're in the media, you can feel embarrassed for a few seconds and then just know that people will forget about it because...
And move on to the next issue, right?
Because, yes, it's a 24-hour news cycle and there's always another story that you can just write about. And most people don't have that kind of sense to think about hindsight and to think about, oh, actually, that wasn't really as big a deal as we thought it was.
But that seems to be what's happening in 2013. Like, yeah. Really, this year, it seems like hacktivism is so 2012. I mean, do you agree with that?
I think so. But at the same time, I used to love trying to predict the future. And these days, I just try and shy away from it now because, especially with something like Anonymous, it's so unpredictable. And when you think about stuff that goes viral on the internet, you can just never predict when something's going to get big and it's going to catch on. And there's so many things that can surprise you in that arena. And yeah.
But do you think if we saw another spree similar to the one engaged in by the Lulzsec guys, do you think it would get the same amount of attention? Because I don't.
I think it probably wouldn't. I think you're right. So I don't know what would get attention. I mean, if you look at the Twitter hacks that have happened, the Syrian Electronic Army, they hacked the AP Twitter feed. That's been getting a lot of attention, but probably not as much as it would have got in 2011 or 2012. Because, as you say, this is something that is kind of being, we're learning about this as we go along. And
it is a case too, isn't it, that people are kind of adapting to this new reality, which is that, oh, okay, things get hacked, but life sort of goes on. Whereas I think in 2011, when all of these targets were going down, people almost felt a bit threatened by that. And they don't now because the sky hasn't fallen. I mean,
Exactly. And I think that's a great point that people, and that's actually, for me, when I was writing about Anonymous and people were always asking me like, well, why are you even writing about this? You're talking to these guys, they might hack you. And it's like, well, I don't, if they do, then so what? It's like, I'm still here. All my limbs are here and I'm physically okay. It's just online data. And yes, it can have a detrimental effect. But as you say, when you look back on what's happened to the targets like Sony and PBS and all those attacks that got huge headlines at the time, the Tupac Shakur article that was uploaded to the PBS NewsHour website, even Aaron Barr, who had 20,000 of his emails put up online, completely embarrassed, had to quit his job and start afresh. In the end, he can just rebuild. Everybody just rebuilds, and they move on. And
so now that the world seems to have realized that there's not a great deal of consequence to the types of activities that these Anonymous guys get up to, that they haven't toppled governments, that they haven't really brought down corporations or anything, that would suggest to me that 90% of their power lay in their ability to sort of instill that fear of these sort of digital wizards where they weren't understood. They kind of are understood now, which would suggest to me that they're only left with that 10%, and that 10% isn't enough to make them a significant force in terms of capturing the public's imagination. They're kind of going to get ignored, and then these are the sort of guys that if you ignore them, their activities are kind of pointless unless they're being reported on.
Right, exactly, and I think that's it exactly. So much of what made them so powerful was their ability to project their power and their sense of fear, and so it was almost like this mirage of power rather than actual damage that they were creating. So it was just a lot of spin. So on the one hand, there has to be a sense of caution about who these guys are, and yes, they can do damage, and yes, they have actually pointed to vulnerabilities in how people in cybersecurity hygiene. A lot of organizations do not protect their customer data as well as they should, and this is what LulzSec helped to highlight.
They certainly did, but I think you don't come at this from a technology point of view, but one of the things that I find interesting is that typically when you look at the way these guys gained access to web servers in particular was through a couple of techniques. One is called SQL injection, and the other one is called file include vulnerabilities. Both very rudimentary flaws that are very easy to fix. And the other way that they would do things is through social engineering. Now, social engineering is still effective, but the other two are getting less and less effective, and it doesn't really seem like the skills of that community are coming up to match the level of protection out there, right? So it kind of seems like they might not have as many targets to pick from anymore. Is that a vibe you're getting from that community now?
I think it's hard for me to say, because I'd love to actually look at statistics that show in the last 12 to 24 months how much investment companies and organizations have actually put into protecting themselves against those kinds of attacks.
Against those bugs. I mean, what's amazing, though, is they were hosting, LulzSec were hosting with, Cloudflare, right? That was the best thing that happened to that business. Yeah. I'm pretty sure they were a startup at that point, and now they're a really well-established service. So if you were selling DDoS mitigation, or if you were selling web application security services, mm-hmm. these guys were the best thing that happened for business. You ask anyone on the trade floor.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And so I think if those kinds of measures have been put in place in the last 12, 24 months across the board, then certainly a lot of, unless best practices are being passed on and improved within the anonymous community in terms of new attack vectors and whatever else, they're just going to be hitting a brick wall now because there's much more protection being put in place. And as I was saying before in the talk, already 2 years ago, people in Anonymous were saying, DDoS, nobody really cares anymore. You take a site down, and again,
it comes back up,
and the key is how the media reports it. That's what they're really looking at, is anyone actually reporting on this? Who reported on us? And if it's just a DDoS attack, then maybe they'll get one mention in one blog, and then that's not enough for them to continue and to maintain perhaps the small group that they've created and attack more targets.
So, Aaron, after the death of Aaron Swartz, I mean, I think someone mentioned it during a talk the other day, people went after the DOJ website and weren't able to get anywhere, but eventually they found like a vulnerable subsite on an MIT web page and sort of went after that. But it didn't really get this huge headline that they wanted.
No, it didn't get that. I think it's a combination of factors. It is that kind of fatigue in the media about this kind of story. Anonymous fatigue, yeah. DDoS fatigue, whatever you want to call it. And at the same time, less people getting involved, less people looking for notoriety because of what happened to people like Sabu and Jake Davis.
Because they all got caught, right?
Yeah, they all got caught. So I think on the one hand, you have people within Anonymous who do want to keep things going, but they're doing so much more quietly. And then the combination that it's actually much harder to get the kind of big name attention that they want. And I've talked to some of these guys who have continued doing big hacks, big leaks, and they kind of say to me, so I tried giving this to The Guardian, I tried giving this to... And they don't want to report it. Reuters doesn't want to. I'm like, well, that's because they're kind of tired of this now. And so they're actually frustrated, some of these hackers who want to be able to...
Because they're not getting the ink.
They're not getting the ink. And it was important to them. And they want to be able to, make a big story out of it.
But I thought it was about the politics, man.
It's always about the politics. It's always about the music, right? But no, it's much more cynical than that. This kind of combination of reasons, I think, is why it's kind of been slowly quietening down. But as I was saying in the talk, It's really hard to just predict this is just going to die out, or to say this is
That was my next question was going to be, what could put Anonymous back on the map in terms of it being a media issue? And that's a very hard question to answer.
I think it's very hard. I wish I had more time to think about the answer to that question, but it's always going to be something that you don't expect, and that's what happened with...
Well, that's what makes it newsworthy. You know, it's got to be counterintuitive, it's got to be surprising, right?
Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, this is something that still appeals to young people. There are still people who consider themselves part of Anonymous. The Anonymous IRC rooms are still there. There are still people in there. There are still the Twitter feeds. So there is some element of that structure still in place. It hasn't gone away yet. So it's there for people to collaborate if they want. And when people collaborate, ideas come and, you know, talents dovetail together, and then things can be created out of nowhere. And that's why it's so difficult to predict what might happen.
Do you think it's possible we might see another countercultural hacker movement along the lines of Anonymous, but reborn under a different name because there's been so much damage done to the Anonymous brand?
Yes, I think so. And the Anonymous brand has been watered down so much and people don't take it seriously. And
because everyone sort of says, I'm Anonymous, right?
And yes, exactly, in the Guy Fawkes mask. So, you know, as with any big institution, it looks sexy and cool at one point, and then slowly over time, like even with Apple, I don't know, like over in a few years, it'll just be...
I would say it's jumped the shark, but the phrase jump the shark has actually jumped the shark.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, right.
I can't think of an alternative.
That is so meta, as they would say in San Francisco. I think something like that, and it probably wouldn't be the Anonymous name. I mean, look at Lulzsec. They chose to have a different name, and that got them a lot of attention. They were often linked to Anonymous, but they were kind of their own thing.
There was this one aspect of your talk which I found really fascinating, which is, you know, the whole idea of the hive mind and being anonymous is, you know, is great, right? But then these guys actually start getting kudos. They start getting access to, like, you know, tighter and tighter concentric rings, which get them closer to more powerful people within the community. Mm-hmm. And the only thing that gets them access to those people is an identity. It might not, it's a pseudonym, but it's still an identity. Mm-hmm. And this is an identity that they don't want to burn. They don't want to get rid of this identity because their identity becomes their status. Mm-hmm. That seemed to me to be to a large degree what Anonymous, what Lulzsec was about, which was about actually having a name, a designation saying, oh, it wasn't just someone random. It was us. It was us who did this. Fear us. Check out our politics. You know, look at our defacements. We did this.
Yeah, which is kind of completely counterintuitive to what the whole idea of Anonymous is supposed to be, that we are anonymous and, you know, we don't have...
Except identity. Here are our names and this is our manifesto and we you know...
Yeah, it's so typical. It's so, you know, hypocrisy running rampant through our humanity, and this is just another example of that. But that's why they were so powerful, is because they'd created this brand. And Anonymous as a brand has been tarnished now. Lulzsec as a brand doesn't really exist anymore because they've all been arrested. So there needs to be a new kind of brand, perhaps. Someone needs to do something, do a lot of it, so that they get a sense of, create a name for themselves.
One thing that strikes me, I mean, the one thing that would really get attention is if some of these guys turned their attentions towards control system hacking. I mean, you shut down a power plant in the name of politics, that's going to get some attention, right?
Yeah. That is the big fear, isn't it? You kind of almost don't want to tempt fate by talking about it, I think, in a way.
You don't want to be sitting here going, you guys have got nothing, you know?
Let's not put this online and give anyone any ideas. But what you're talking about, the power infrastructure and the ability to kind of like, well, you just type in something and then this... some gas mains is going to explode over there, and it's so easy to do that. You know, I've heard that being said at cybersecurity conferences before, and why hasn't anyone done it yet? And people keep asking this question.
Well, and this is the thing, is because no one with the skills currently is motivated to do that, right? I mean, people say, oh, it's possible for a foreign state to blow up your power plant, but it's also possible for a foreign state to fly a plane over your power plant and drop a bomb on it.
Right.
The reason they don't do that is because it's a shitty thing to do and there are going to be consequences.
Yeah.
Then again, when you're dealing with a wild card sort of, you know, offbeat, politically motivated attacker, they might actually want to do that. Mm-hmm. There is someone with the motivation, and it would be these, you know, this particular stripe of person. Would you agree with that?
Well, that's why motivation was something I wanted to try and really focus on with the talk, because in the end, the skills are there, the ability is there, the opportunity is there, the vulnerability is there, and all you really need is the motivation to actually make it happen, and the people coming together and deciding, making the decision, yes, we're going to do this and we're going to target. And that hasn't happened yet in what you're describing. Yet, I don't want to say yet, but it hasn't happened. And so, you know, what are the motivations that drive people? Well, a lot of it when you really, really go back, it comes from this culture, this online culture of trolling, of vigilantism. And as I was saying before, that's kind of been watered down a bit as more people have come online. 4chan isn't really the kind, it really isn't the kind of community that it was several years ago. Even Anonymous has been, it's just so big, everybody's heard of it, it's not intimate anymore. So how do you kind of share that sense? How do you galvanize people into action? How do you imbue a sense of motivation to go after a target? How do you
Rally the troops?
Yeah, you have to find a target. You have to create a sense of us and them, that this is an enemy and this is us. And I think it's just harder to do that now online.
Yeah, it's really funny when we look at the way people are sort of indoctrinated. I mean, it's self-indoctrination into these sorts of groups. But during your talk, I mean, there's really, I mean, we're talking about disenfranchised young men rallying around a common purpose and doing some stuff that's going to get him into trouble. Now, I'm not drawing parallels between the actions of groups like Anonymous with terrorist organizations, but they're, you know, idiots, right? But I would say that the indoctrination element, there seems to be some really strong parallels there, which is like disenfranchised young people rallying around this sense of us and them. So for a lot of young Muslim men, it's like you know, our way of life is under threat. You know, Muslims are being attacked. And for these guys, they're saying our online liberties are being attacked. Our, you know, our freedoms are being attacked. They want to censor the internet. They want to suppress information. There's some pretty strong parallels there, you would think.
Yeah, absolutely. And
it's hard to say that without sounding alarmist, though, right?
But it is true, and that's one of the first things. And even just in terms of the structure, like if you look at Anonymous and Al-Qaeda, again, it's like people often project this image of an organization when that isn't there at all. It's more like a starfish. You cut off an arm and another grows back, and it's very nodal, and it's a network. And yeah, I think it's what you described just then, young men fearing the sense that their liberties are being taken away online.
Feeling that they're under threat, feeling that there is a them.
Yes, but I just, you know, you could see that a few years ago, and not as much now. It's, I don't know, I feel as though when you had the, for instance, a few months ago, there was this...
I liked Lulzsec until Sabu got all political, right? That was, you know, I liked it when they were for the lulls, but then he was a revolution. Anyway, sorry.
But that was effective in keeping them going, right? And that was something that had been there from very, very early on. And it rubbed off on the guys in the group as well, and they were very much taken in by it, and it create kind of... you know, emboldens this sense, this motivation, and it kind of keeps them going, the sense of self-righteousness. And I just think it's, you know, what is going to be the cause that they pick up that, you know, in late 2010, it was WikiLeaks. You need one thing to just bring people together. You know, it started off with WikiLeaks, and then it moved on to the Middle East, and then it moved on to something else, and then they just changed the cause over time.
But the ACTA thing didn't really have as much oomph, did it, as the WikiLeaks thing?
The what? The ACTA.
Yeah.
Right. And, you know, I think a year ago, 2 years ago, there might have been more interest in ACTA and SOPA. The big blackouts that were happening by Wikipedia and other sites like Reddit, when SOPA was a big deal about a year ago, when I was talking to Christopher Poole, he was saying 1 year later, we might not have had that kind of reaction. Just because attitudes towards regulating the internet are changing, people just don't care as much as
apathy creeps in, right?
Yeah, and I think there's apathy around the whole idea of privacy. And I wonder if there's some relation to that, young people not caring as much about the privacy of their data online as people did 5, 10 years.
Adjusting to the new reality.
Yeah, I think so.
So you reckon it could be just about, you know, there needs to be a real doozy of a cause, basically, in order to sort of fire this up again.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. I'd love to know what it is. With WikiLeaks, when Anonymous really came back in late 2010, it wasn't WikiLeaks and Cablegate, it was the arrest of Julian Assange that really got people upset and that made people want to join in and just say, I want to be a part of this. Who's doing something? Oh, Anonymous is doing something. I'm going to get involved. So this sense that someone is being mistreated, there has to be a kind of a single figure that people can kind of attach themselves to and want to stand up for. Some kind of scenario like that has to come up, I think, for Anonymous to ever really come back and become big again. Otherwise, it continues to just be these small groups of vigilante-style actions against you know, to align themselves with issues like the Steubenville rape case. That's the only time we're really seeing Anonymous in the news now.
All right, well, Palmy Olsen, that's a whole other topic, that one. But it's been a pleasure to chat to you. I really enjoyed your talk. And thanks for finding some time. I know you're only here for a short time, so thanks for finding some time to speak to Risky Business.
Sure, it's my pleasure. Thank you.
Tommy Olsen there with a chat about what hacktivism might look like in the future. It is time for this week's sponsor interview now with Sanitas CTO and co-founder Julian Fay. Sanitas makes layer 2 encryption equipment. So whether you're securing a data center, a link to a data center or a huge control system deployment, if you're into layer 2 encryption, you really want to check them out. It's great kit, designed and manufactured here in Australia. So Julian joined me via Skype to tell me all about the latest developments in homomorphic encryption. Being someone who has, well, until yesterday, had no idea what homomorphic encryption actually is, I started off by asking Julian to explain it to me.
So it's an idea that's been around since the 70s that gets cryptographic researchers very excited. It's kind of, in some ways, it's kind of like the holy grail of cryptography. And a bit like mathematicians used to get really excited about solving Fermat's last theorem, cryptographers get really excited about the design of a practical, fully homomorphic encryption system. So the basic idea behind it is that it's a new encryption scheme that allows you to do useful work over encrypted data. That may not sound terribly exciting when you first hear it, but actually when you think it through, it's got some pretty profound implications.
When you think it through, honestly, you think, how on earth would something like this possibly work? I mean, you're talking about actually performing operations on encrypted data while it's still encrypted. I mean, what?
Yeah, I know. It's one of those kind of ideas that does your head in.
I'd love to be able to fly down to the shops instead of drive, but I don't know that this is possible.
It's a bit like spooky action at a distance, quantum entanglement, where you can change a photon here and something else happens at the same time on the other side of the world. It's one of those kind of categories.
Yes, yeah, it is. But sorry, I did interrupt you, and you were about to tell me about what some of the implications for getting this to work would be.
Yeah, so it basically allowed you to delegate work over an encrypted data set without revealing or compromising the security of the data set that you're working over. So the kind of the classic use case is some sort of cloud security environment. Let's say you've got a database that you want to store on some cloud service and you want to run queries over it. You want to, it's a useful database that you're regularly using. So, but the service provider is probably someone who's untrusted. So you've got a couple of options. One option is that you can put the whole database up there unencrypted. You can run your queries very efficiently. But of course, you then bear the risk that the untrusted third party isn't going to abuse that data set. A more secure approach, of course, would be just to encrypt the whole thing using your key, put it up in the cloud encrypted. But that greatly reduces the utility of it, and it makes it very difficult to actually run useful queries over it. So homomorphic encryption is kind of a scheme that allows you to kind of have your cake and eat it, because it kind of solves both those problems. So it would allow you to have a fully encrypted data set that's under your own key, but it would allow you to run useful queries over it and get back an encrypted result without compromising the nature of the database, the original data, or any information about the result itself, which sounds completely nuts. I mean, how the hell is that going to work?
But it's not completely nuts. This is the thing. I mean, there's been some research into this area which shows that you can perform some rudimentary operations on encrypted data and get an encrypted result, and it all works out somehow. How does this happen?
Yeah, so up until 2009, it was kind of one of those beautiful ideas but completely impractical kind of schemes that everybody thought, oh, I'd love to have that, but we'll never ever have that sort of system. And then a breakthrough occurred. So there's this guy called Craig Gentry, who was a PhD candidate at Stanford. He went off to IBM to do some research, and he wrote a paper about it's basically an existence theorem or a blueprint for a fully homomorphic encryption architecture. So one of the things that Gentry does in his paper is he uses a really nice analogy to sort of help people understand the concept of it. And the analogy he uses is of a jewelry store owner. So you've got a jewelry store owner, and she's got some workers working for her. Of course, her name is Alice. And she wants these workers to make fine necklaces and rings from raw materials that are gold, ruby, silver, etc. But she doesn't trust the workers. So she thinks that if she just gives them the raw materials, there's a good chance they'll just nick them and walk out of the shop. So her way of solving this problem is to come up with a secure scheme that's based around a locked glove box. So this is, you've probably seen them, one of these big boxes that's locked, but it's got gloves on the side that are completely sealed. So you can put your hand in to this glove box, and you can actually use the gloves to manipulate objects inside the box.
Like what Homer Simpson uses in the opening credits,
exactly.
With that whole uranium rod, right?
Yeah. Sort of nuclear plant type stuff, or working with toxic chemicals, that kind of thing. So in this analogy that he uses in his paper, the workers in this jewelry store, they get given one of these closed boxes that's got the raw components in it. They put their hands in the gloves, and then they can manipulate these raw components, and that pops a nice ring or a necklace or something at the end of it, and then they just hand it back to Alice, the jewelry store owner, and only she's got the key to unlock the box and actually get the final goods out. So it's quite a nice little analogy for kind of explaining the intuitions behind how this technique works, and then it expands on that to kind of explain how the maths works at each step. It's a good read. And once he published that paper, people kind of realized that actually there was a practical way of doing it and of building such a system. Unfortunately, what the method that he proposed at the time was so incredibly computationally expensive.
Yeah, I was going to say this doesn't sound efficient.
Stuff. Like it was, to do something like a simple search over a database, it was like a trillion times more computation was required to actually get a meaningful result. So again, it was completely impractical at that time. But because he published that paper, what it's allowed over the last 4 or 5 years is a huge number of other researchers to actually look at his scheme, and he's continued working on it himself. And DARPA, for instance, have thrown several million dollars in research to try and improve the efficiencies. And there have been some giant strides in this area. And most recently, I think it was April, IBM actually published for the first time an open source software toolkit that was an API for an implementation of fully homomorphic encryption, which is going to be really interesting for researchers in the future and will hopefully accelerate yet again work in this area.
Yeah, but I mean, I would imagine the types of operations that you can perform in a homomorphic system would be pretty simple, almost to the point of not being terribly useful. Or is that, or can it actually get quite sophisticated?
The whole point of a fully homomorphic encryption is that you can do any arbitrary complex computation over encrypted data. So essentially, whatever you can imagine, you can do. And to have a fully homomorphic system, you've got to basically have it homomorphic over both multiplication and addition. So let me give you a simple example. It turns out that a lot of our existing public key encryption algorithms, such as pure RSA, so that's RSA without any of the padding that goes into the PKCS standards, turns out that that's homomorphic over multiplication. So for example, if I've got ciphertext C1 and C2, that are the ciphertext of two plain messages, M1 and M2, but I don't know what those plain text messages are, but if I actually need to know what the multiplication of M1 and M2 is, turns out I can multiply C1 by C2.
And then just decrypt it and out pops your answer.
Exactly. Yeah. So that's the equivalent of encrypting M1 times M2. So some of our existing algorithms are homomorphic over multiplication. Some of them are homomorphic over addition and other operations. So what you need is a system, a new encryption system that's homomorphic over both addition and multiplication. And then what you can do is you can break down any computation into essentially a circuit that consists of a number of Boolean gates. Lots of AND or NOT gates, etc. And then you can define that as a sequence of addition and multiplication steps.
So it all sort of comes together, and the calculation is essentially performed at the time that you want to decrypt it.
Exactly. So there's a ton of work to get to there. But in theory, any complex function can be done in this way.
Okay. So who's actually using this? Is anyone actually using this yet, or is it very much at the development stage still?
It's still very much at the development stage. I think we're still a long way, probably many years away, from having a kind of really practical, useful homomorphic encryption scheme. But I think we'll start to see interesting use cases come up probably in the next few years. You can use partial homomorphic, which is where it just supports multiplication or addition, for some use already, for example, counting votes. You can, for example, let's say you want to know the result of a ballot, but you don't actually want to open the ballot box. There are some schemes that allow you to use a homomorphic technique to calculate the sum of all the individual votes without actually revealing who voted for what. So there's some sort of simpler applications like that that might be useful in the short term. But because it's been published, and there is actually now a toolkit for users to go and play with, you can download it from GitHub, you can compile this stuff, have a play around. I think it's going to probably ignite a lot of interest in the area and probably and hopefully accelerate future research.
Yeah, it might kick the can down the road a little bit more. I got to ask too, as the developer and manufacturer of cryptographic systems, is this something that you guys are keeping an eye on in terms of finding commercial applications for it?
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, like I said, it's always been the kind of holy grail of computing. And it really kind of closes the loop on the promise of secure cloud computing. So once it has some real utility, you know, once you can actually use this for practical things, it's going to drive a huge amount of business in this area. And I think the first adopters, the people who actually can do real practical, useful work with this, are going to make a killing. So yeah, very interesting keeping an eye on it. I think it's, you know, we're still a way away, as I said, but it's definitely a landmark in cryptography and the research that's going on in that area. The homomorphic schemes are brand new encryption schemes. So in a conventional encryption scheme, of course, you've got three key algorithms. You've got a key generation mechanism, you've got an encryption mechanism, and a decryption mechanism. And a homomorphic encryption scheme, you add a fourth algorithm called evaluate, which basically operates over a set of predefined functions using a public key. And that's what's actually used to do these very interesting homomorphic encryptions over the computed data. So that would be very, very useful because, as you said, you could build whole systems around this to keep everything completely secure, including the nature of the query, the nature of the work that's done, the result of the work, and, of course, the data itself.
All righty. Well, Julian Fay, that is pretty twisted stuff. Thank you for turning up to warp our minds a little bit with a discussion around homomorphic encryption.
Great. Thanks, Pat.
Julian Fay there with a chat about homomorphic encryption. And that is it for this week's show. A big thanks again to Senatas for bringing you the program. And I also want to thank Ant, who is my sound guy at Ossert. Thanks, buddy. Great job. And really, really do go and check out the Ossert coverage at risky.biz/Ossert. This week's track is called Siki, and it's by Rokia Traor, who is Malian. But I bought this album in Cape Town when I was over there in South Africa, and you can get it on iTunes. I've included a link in this week's show notes to a YouTube video of her performing this live, so you get the spelling of her name and the track all down. Until next week, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening.
Hey, see, hey, 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 hey,